Good morning.
So, as you may know, I think Zen practice can be transformative for individuals and for our society. It can make the world a better place. And to really get to the heart of Zen practice, we can't think only about what it's like to practice here in the Zendo. We have to think about what it's like to take our practice out into the world. So from time to time, I like doing talks that apply a Zen view to some of the very difficult issues that we face as a society. And today's talk has been percolating for a long time. I think I've been thinking about this talk for years, actually. It's quite personal, and it won't be an easy talk for me to give. I almost lost my nerve a couple times this week. But I feel compelled to give it. As a Zen teacher, I feel compelled to go toward those places of pain and suffering and difficulty, because we're here to do the difficult work. That's how we heal ourselves. That's how we heal our society. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how people oppress other people, and I'm going to touch upon the roots of aggression. I'm going to ask, what is the dynamic when groups of people try to dominate other groups of people? And I'm going to talk about maybe one source of that. So this is kind of a trigger warning. I'm not going to talk about anything really graphic, but I am going to talk about how groups of people can be cruel to innocent victims. And if you would find that hard to hear, if you're just not up for that today, and you'd rather not listen, and you'd like to slip out at some point, that is perfectly okay. So, my subject is gender, and how rigid views of gender and gender roles can harm all of us. And it's connected to sexism and homophobia. It's connected to bias against transgender people, and it's connected to bigotry, which is bias against anyone who is different from the person who is biased. And I'm going to start with a Zen view of what gender is. I'm going to quote Grace Shearson, who is, I think still, but I'm not sure, abbess of the Empty Nest Zendo in California, and she's also a clinical psychologist. And this is from her book, Zen Women, Beyond Tea Ladies, Iron Maidens, and Macho Masters, which is a pretty intriguing title. So, in one part of the book, she's commenting on an exchange between a female monk and a male monk. The female is Moshan, who was abbess of her own temple in China around 800, and the male is Guanxi. And I won't go into detail about the exchange because it's quite long, but I'll tell you that Moshan gets the best of the male monk. She refutes this simply awful view, which had appeared in Buddhist sutras and had been carried over from earlier Hindu beliefs, that a female must transform into a male to achieve Buddhahood. And Grace Shearson says that this was the first time in the history of Zen that we find a full-fledged female teacher teaching a man at her own temple. And Grace Shearson says, on the level of the absolute, there are no genders. On the level of relative reality, there are just many different forms. Why, then, would these forms need to transform? This exchange about the essential, formless, genderless quality of it established Moshan as a Zen master, and it simultaneously validated women's ability to teach Dharma in the face of Buddhist superstition. So, this quote tells us a couple of things. For one, Buddhism has not been immune from sexism. I think a lot of progress has been made. I think it still has a ways to go. Also, it tells us that it is essentially genderless. It can be thought of as thusness, the absolute, or big mind. It has no gender quality. And that is consistent with my personal experience. In samadhi, there are no personal qualities. There is no gender. Also, this quote tells us that here in the world of relative reality, here in the world of forms, there are just many different forms. And I read that to mean that there aren't just two forms, male and female, but that things are more complicated than that. And I think this is consistent with the Zen approach to everything. Strict categorization misconstrues reality. Things exist on a continuum. There is male and there is female. We all have some of each within us, in our brains and in our bodies. I think that there are infinite combinations of male and female among individuals, and that makes the human experience rich and diverse. And to deny this and to try to force men and women into strict gender roles is to deny the complexity of reality and to cause suffering. And we have a nice symbol of this in Buddhism, something we see on our altars in statuary, in the way the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion has evolved over the years. As Avalokiteshvara in India, this Bodhisattva was always represented as male. But in China, this Bodhisattva became Kuan Yin, and she was represented sometimes as female, or sometimes as being asexual, or sometimes as combining elements of both genders. So gender, I think, is somewhat fluid. And like everything else that we think we know about, gender is a mental construct. If you try to pin it down, even here in the world of forms, I don't think it really exists. You can try to draw an absolute line between male and female based on anatomy, but even that distinction breaks down, I think, because anatomy can be ambiguous or in between, and anatomy can be changed. And who says that anatomy defines it anyway? Anatomy is just one component of gender. And yet, humans have this very persistent urge to define gender and gender roles very precisely. For instance, there's the view that which bathroom you use must be determined by your anatomy at birth. And all of this, I think, has led to tremendous suffering. There's a great deal of cruelty related to gender, gender roles, and sexual orientation. And I'd like to talk about that today. I'm going to be talking from my own perspective. And I'm going to emphasize the harmful effect of rigid gender roles on men. But I want to stress that, of course, men, at least straight men, are not the primary victims of the things I'm talking about. The primary victims are women and gays and transgender people. And those things need to be talked about as well, of course. But if we're going to look at interconnections, as we must, we have to acknowledge that things like sexism and homophobia, though they may be perpetrated by straight men, hurt straight men too in many ways. There's a book called My Grandmother's Hands by Resma Menakem, and it focuses on race, not gender, but it totally applies here. In talking about race, Resma Menakem says that many African Americans know trauma intimately, but they are not alone in this. A different but equally real form of racialized trauma lives in the bodies of most white Americans. And a third kind of racialized trauma exists in the bodies of many of America's law enforcement officers. All three types of trauma are passed down from generation to generation, he says, and that is why white body supremacy continues to persist in America. And he says, this is a quote, "The destruction will continue until Americans of all cultures and colors learn to acknowledge the inherited trauma of white body supremacy embedded in all our bodies." So we need to work through this trauma. The process differs slightly for black folks, white folks, and America's police, he says. But all of us need to heal, and all of us can. And I think it's the same with gender. We all are hurt, and we all need to heal. And I think it's worth looking at the effect of male behavior on other men, because the way men deal with each other is a key to the way men are with women and gay and transgender individuals. And the way men are with each other has to change if any of this is going to change. Men have the responsibility to call each other on bad behavior. Steve, could you move that bowl so I'll be able to see the clock? Thank you. And also that bell. All right. So I don't pretend to be an expert on any of this. I'm offering my own experience in hopes that it'll be somehow helpful. It's taken me a lifetime to untangle some of the early conditioning I received. And I know there's a lot of new thinking about all of this and new terminology about gender issues that I'm probably not completely familiar with. And maybe it's taken me a lifetime to get to the place where some of you folks, particularly you younger folks, are right now. So I may be a little naive. I may get some stuff wrong. You may see that I've recently discovered things that have always been obvious to you. So please be patient while you listen to an old guy, well, a slightly old guy, work through this stuff. So I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. And the first one is about my first experience with sewing. This happened in first grade. This was in a tiny town in the Midwest, and there were four of us in the first grade, me and three girls, and we shared our room with the second and third grades, three grades in one room. And one day, we first graders were assigned the task of making a puppet. So it was a finger puppet with a little styrofoam head. And it needed some clothing, so it would have kind of a cape around it, a little cape. So we cut out this band of cloth, and we were to put four stitches to close it up, four little X-shaped stitches. And that sounds pretty simple, right? Well, it wasn't simple for me. It was actually a little traumatic for me. And you know why? Because boys did not sew. And I remember thinking, if those second and third grade boys see me sewing, I will never hear the end of it. They will make fun of me, and they will call me a girl. And I can remember looking around and hoping no one was watching and kind of holding that puppet underneath my desk and working on it down there, just scared to death. And needless to say, I didn't do a very good job. but what this story tells me is that by age six, I had gotten a very strong message about gender roles. And where did that come from? Well, from a number of sources, I think. I think my mom was pretty open-minded, I remember. I had two brothers at that time. There were three of us boys, but we had a doll and we had a dollhouse, and my mom did that deliberately. She thought, you know, boys should have these things. Also, my mom did a lot of farm work, she did not really adhere to rigid gender roles, but my dad didn't really do housework and he didn't really cook, so there was some imbalance there. And I can remember just one incident where my dad said something overt about how I should be as a male. And I think I was, again, probably about six or maybe seven. And we were down in the dirt for some reason. I don't remember why. But I remember there was a worm there, and he knew I was afraid to touch it. And he just said, "You don't want to be a sissy." And when your dad says something like that, it has a powerful impact, you know. So I didn't want to be that thing. And later on, I would find worms, and I would pick them up, and I would, you know, kind of grit my teeth. And I was afraid of snakes, too, but I'd pick them up, you know, and probably killed off a little piece of myself, but that's what I did. And in those days, this was around 1960, of course, those attitudes were really pervasive, especially on TV, but I think probably the biggest thing was peer pressure at school. And among the girls in our school, the big thing to do at recess was cheerleading in the gym. They'd go out there and they'd do cheers. And when I was six, I was the only boy in my class, and it really looked like fun. So I joined in, and it was fun. Doing cheers is fun. But I think within about 2 or 3 days, my cheerleading career ended for all time because those older boys started laughing at me and calling me a girl. And, of course, at the same time, the girls were getting a similar message, but opposite. And a lot of them weren't able to do things they wanted to do, like playing sports and or maybe working out in the fields if they grew up on farms, or maybe riding their bikes far from home, which is something that all us boys got to do. So the message I got from all of these sources was that acting like a girl and not acting like a real man was just about the very worst thing I could do. And it took a long, long time to get past that. But I did. Occasionally I see a vestige of that in myself, this little twinge. Oh no, can't do that. But mostly I got over it. Over time, I just realized how stupid it all was. And of course, I got into different environments where people were more open-minded, and the times have really changed in most places, not everywhere. And I had my Zen practice, and Zen practice makes deep rewiring possible. And you know something that really helped was my ordination as a Zen priest, which took place right here, maybe 13 years ago. That ceremony, as we've set it up, I think in a way is meant to minimize gender. When I got ordained, I got my head shaved, and I shaved off my beard and my mustache. And since I was about 18, I've always had at least a mustache. So it was quite a shock the first time I looked in the mirror in my bald state and discovered what my face looks like. And I immediately thought, wow, that's what I looked like when I was about 9 years old. And the next time I looked in the mirror, I saw my mom's face in my face. And I thought, wow, that's me. Mom, that's me. And the next morning, I remember I was over at Dunn Brothers, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw my dad's face. Wow, that's me. My dad. And there's something about standing up in front of 40 people wearing something that looks very much like a dress and taking these vows that's kind of liberating, because you can do that and you have to be afraid about what anybody is going to think. I mean, to some extent, monks all look alike. Sometimes you see monks with shaved heads. You don't know what their gender is right away. And then there's the sewing. I've spent a great deal of time sewing, sewing a rakasu and sewing robes with my Dharma sisters and brothers, and I think I've gotten way past that gender trauma sewing thing. Now, I'm not saying I've overcome all of my conditioning. I still have my blind spots. I still have things to work on. I still don't do enough housework. And I'm not saying that Zen has overcome its sexist history, but I think progress is being made in these areas. So eventually, I realize that I can act like a girl if I want to. And just saying that, especially in this public way, I still, you know, I kind of, or in preparing this, I don't feel it now, but I felt like this little twinge of fear. But I know that there is nothing wrong with saying that. And furthermore, I could present myself to the world as a woman if I wanted to. I could become a woman if I wanted to. Do I want to? Well, I'm not going to tell you. It's not relevant for purposes of this talk. And it's kind of liberating to be able to say these things. I'm just done with worrying about that whole thing, whether I'm manly enough. Life is too short. I am what I am. A view of two fixed genders with fixed roles does not fit Zen. Gender is a mental construct that we make. Like any mental construct, it has some usefulness. For instance, you need to talk about gender if you're going to talk about gender equality, but like any mental construct, it also has limitations, many limitations. And in rejecting that construct lies freedom. Freedom for me, freedom for all guys, freedom for women, and even freedom for the oppressors who try to enforce strict gender roles and who can learn that they don't have to act that way and they don't have to live with the knowledge of their own cruelty and with the constant nagging fear that the oppressed will rise up against them. So here's another story from my childhood. It's kind of an unpleasant story, but I need to tell it in order to make my further point, which is about how male group behavior can contribute to this rigid view of gender roles in a very destructive way. because I'm concerned about aggression and violence. And I think to do something about it, it's necessary to explain where it comes from and what sustains it. So when I was 14, I got my first real job hoeing weeds out in the farm fields. And a bunch of us boys would gather at a place in town, and they'd load us into the back of a truck. It was a big grain truck, and it had a tarp over the top, and then there was a bench along each side for us to sit on. So there were maybe 20 of us in there. And they'd drive us out to a farm somewhere, and we'd take our hoes, and we'd chop the weeds out of the field. And I loved having a job, and I enjoyed the work, and I made some good friends on that crew. But the whole thing turned into this kind of a Lord of the Flies type deal. We were totally unsupervised in the back of the truck, and these kids who were 14 or 15, they would just do stupid things. Like one day a kid put a frog in the drinking water, so none of us had water to drink that day. And I joined in mid-season, and I noticed that one kid always rode up front with the supervisor. And he was a really big kid, a really hefty kid. And I found out the reason he rode up there was for his own protection, because the kids had been so cruel to him. And I don't know what happened to that particular kid, but sometimes kids, what they'll do in a situation like this is that some of them, not all of them, they'll just attack the kid, you know. They'll just attack the kid. Maybe give him a snuggie. You know what a snuggie is? They pull your underwear way up, like to your neck or over your head, and it's painful. But it's not the pain that really matters. It's the attack. It's about the fear that builds up as they choose their victim, and about the humiliation when they pounce. And in a way, it's kind of just horseplay, and maybe it's even kind of funny, and they're just kids, and they should be forgiven. And they really should be forgiven, because kids do stupid things, you know. But it's really kind of not funny, because it's typical of the kind of destructive group behavior that can happen in all male situations. And of course, you know that this kind of behavior can manifest itself in more adult situations, which can turn mean, and they can turn violent. That kind of energy may be turned against a guy in the group, or maybe against an outsider. And it may be the whole group turning against someone, or it may be just a couple of guys who feel that they kind of have the backing of the group, because they know how the group works. And sometimes this kind of mentality is encouraged by men in authority. This kind of thing works if you want to get things done. The group keeps everyone in line, and then the group has this group identity and group mores, and it accomplishes its goals. And often this kind of thing is turned against someone who is not considered sufficiently masculine. So maybe my dad, when he said, "You don't want to be a sissy," maybe he thought he was protecting me. You know, he was a shy, mild-mannered farm kid who would never hurt anyone. But he enlisted in the army, and he served during World War II, and he went to Germany. He'd been around. He knew how things work. And perhaps he thought this was information I needed to have, so the pack would never turn on me. Because that's the big fear if you're a guy, that the pack will turn on you. So there's the question of your own immediate safety. And if it's a small town, you know that you may be around these same guys for the rest of your life. And the guys who lead the pack when you're a kid may end up leading the town when you're an adult. If you go against the pack, you may be an outsider for the rest of your life. And I've seen this kind of dynamic again and again in all-male environments. I saw it in an all-male college dorm. I've seen it in locker rooms. I've seen it on construction sites especially. I saw it throughout high school when I myself was bullied repeatedly for 2 years because I had long hair and outspoken political beliefs. So I've seen the pack in operation. And not everyone knows how this works, but here's how it works. The meanest and loudest guy in the room says something mean and loud about someone else who may or may not be present. And then he gets a good laugh, and he's emboldened. And then he and his minions start looking around in the present company for someone to harass. And it could be based on race or gender or perceived masculinity or appearance or body type. It could be anything. it doesn't really matter to them. They need someone to oppress because that's how they get their power. So you have the leader who is the meanest, loudest guy, and you have his intended victim, and then let's say there are 10 other guys there. 3 of the guys will laugh loudly because they want to be part of the fun. They want to be part of the dominant group. And 3 guys will laugh just enough to let everyone know that they are with the program. And 3 guys will stay silent because they know it's wrong, but they're afraid to speak up. And the 10th guy is a guy who knows it's wrong and he has the potential to speak up. And he may speak up, and that's going to take some courage, maybe a lot of courage. And he may not, and that may be from a lack of courage, but it may be from a calculation about his own personal safety. I've usually been that 10th guy with that potential, and sometimes I have spoken out, and sometimes I have not. So anyway, I've painted a kind of a grim picture. And of course, this thing doesn't always happen. And when it does, it usually doesn't result in some kind of violence or humiliation. But what it does result in often is, and this is equally destructive, is it establishes the mores of the group, their customs and conventions. When someone says something mean about someone outside the group, and they get a laugh from someone, and silence from others, then the mean thing is established. It has been said, and no one opposed it. And it's safe to assume no one will ever oppose it. And that's how the very worst racist and sexist views are perpetuated. And I don't think this dynamic gets enough attention. The dynamic that when men treat women badly, or gay people badly, or transgender people badly, the roots of that may be in the way men are treating each other. And I'm not condemning men here. I'm condemning the worst of male behavior. And I know that women are capable of bad behavior too. And to say that only men are responsible for aggression would be to ignore that gender really is on a continuum. But there is a certain kind of group behavior that is overwhelmingly male. Men do these things and men must put a stop to them. And of course, not all men are like this. Far from it. These are tales from the hinterland long ago. And I suppose I've spent quite a lot of my life in kind of rough company. But I'm so happy that now I'm able to live in a world where such behavior is very rare. And my buddies are Zen guys, and Zen guys are great. I love Zen guys. Zen guys brag about how good they are at ironing. Zen guys confront other guys who say things that are really unkind. Zen guys may feel badly because sometimes in their long lives they've been jerks and they really want you to forgive them and they're not going to do it anymore. Zen guys are sweet. Guys can be sweet. And if you're a guy and the kind of stuff I'm talking about seems really weird to you and you have never witnessed this kind of thing, I am so glad to hear that. I am thrilled to hear that because it is possible to move in circles where it really doesn't happen, particularly here in the Twin Cities. And it's possible to raise boys in a way that keeps them free of these ideas of rigid gender roles and the kind of male group behavior that I've been talking about. And there's a great film about this called The Mask You Live In, and I have a brochure about it here, which I can show you later if you're interested. Which talks about the harmfulness of messages that encourage boys, this is a quote, to disconnect from their emotions, devalue authentic friendships, objectify women, and resolve conflicts through violence. Disconnecting from their emotions, that's a whole other thing that I haven't even talked about. So I don't know how much my son, who is 33, has experienced this kind of thing. I think not so much, and that's great. And it would be so nice to be able to say that it's a thing of the past, but I'm afraid it is not. At the heart of it is this persistent false belief that we've had throughout history that one can gain well-being from dominating other people. It's not true, but it is persistent. It persists at many levels of our society, including the highest levels, this bullying mentality, And it may even seem in some ways that it's at kind of a pinnacle right now, but it is my hope that right now it is making its last gasp, its last desperate gasp, and that everything is going to be seen for what it is, and it is going to end. And it has to, because it is so destructive. And I want to address that mean, loud guy at the top, your little fun that creates your power and keeps you in power, damages people for life, and it creates a cruel society where no one, including you, ever feels secure. Because you know you got to where you are by hurting people, you know they hate you, and you know that your position is perilous. And furthermore, I want you to know that your day is over. No longer will you earn and keep your place at the head of the pack by denigrating and humiliating others, by picking out people for abuse based on race or gender or whatever quality you choose to pick out. No longer is that going to happen, and we are not always going to be polite with you. And I want to address you three guys who laugh the loudest. You think you have courage? You'll follow that mean, loud guy anywhere. You'll follow that guy into battle, and you'll even die for him. But when it comes to asking whether he could possibly be wrong and standing up to him if he is wrong, you have no courage at all. And I would like to see some real courage from you. And the other people I want to address are those three guys, those guys who laugh just enough to show that they're with the program, and those three guys who don't laugh at all because they're scared to speak up, and even that tenth guy who is debating about whether to stand up, because it's you seven guys who really give that top guy his power, and it is you who can change the world. Yes, I know you're afraid of the pack. I know you may even fear for your safety. I'm not asking you to endanger yourself. But come on, give us something. Give us something. At least don't laugh. If you don't laugh, maybe your buddy won't laugh either. And maybe his buddy won't laugh. And the guy will topple. Just like that. You may be scared, but remember, the bully's days are doomed. You can cling to the wrong side of history, or you can move toward the winning side. Culture is changing. Maleness is no longer equivalent to cruelty. Those days are over. And you may surmise that I feel a little anger about this, and that may surprise you, because you don't usually see anger from me. And I usually don't get angry in a reactive sense. Because of my practice. I feel a little twinge now and then, but it doesn't last long. But in preparing this talk, I did discover or get reacquainted with a kind of slow, sad anger about cruelty that has persisted for many years. Well, it's good to acknowledge anger, and it's good to process it. There's even a place for anger in social and political movements. But I hope it never consumes us, because that would debilitate us and it would not help anyone. I'm not going to allow anger to consume me. There are ways to work with anger. And I'd refer you again to the book My Grandmother's Hands, because that's about looking to how we store trauma in our bodies and how to heal ourselves by getting out of our thoughts and into our bodies. And this is entirely consistent with Zen practice. And I don't want to leave you in an angry place today. So I would like to ask you to please sit up straight and close your eyes, or leave them open just a bit if that's what you're accustomed to. And I would like to bring your, I would like you to bring your attention to your body. And how it feels? How does it feel to be sitting on this chair or on this zafu? And bring your attention to your breathing. Very very close attention to what it feels like to breathe in and out. And now, please bring your attention to your body again. Do you feel tension anywhere? Have my words brought stress to your body in any way? Now, if this is hard for you, if you don't want to touch that tension right now, just go back to your breath and stay with your breath. But if you're okay with it, if you're ready for it, just note how you're feeling and forget all of my words, forget your thoughts, and feel the physical feelings in your body and allow them to be. Don't think about how it should feel or how you want it to feel. Just feel that. Just let it be. Be present with the physical feeling. Remember that in your fear you can find your strength. May I be aware of the suffering of the world. May I understand that the sources of suffering are complex. May I acknowledge the suffering of all beings. May I do my best to be kind and gentle in the world and to be firm when it's necessary. May I do this without allowing myself to be lost in emotion. May I heal myself and heal others and practice forgiveness. May I accept the support of others in this endeavor and know that I am not alone. May I and my community, with courage and with persistence, practice kindness. Thank you. Whew. Thank you for listening. Anyone have anything they would like to say?
Well, that opens up a big can of worms.
It does.
Yeah. I'm Judy, and I've been a student here for a long time, and then I leave, and then I come back. But, I was here when there was a lot of action by the board, and I was on the board when there were investigations into people at Zen Center having improper sexual contact with each other.
Can you folks in the dark? Could you
sexual power, sexual position, gender. Gender dynamics.
Here at Zen Center, yes.
It was happening all over the country, and it happened here too. So, as a Sangha, you know, how do you heal from that? In my experience, because I was working with people who had been victimized by it, who needed representation by the board, you listen to everybody. You listen to everybody involved. And you take in their suffering, because there's a lot of suffering from that. And, you know, I think the community kind of fell apart for a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was very hard to recover from. But it is on a personal level, too, like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But as a community, I just think it's important to listen to each other. And, you know, I've been watching Zen Center for a long time, and when Tim came on board, the communication with the Sangha changed. The board became more interactive with the Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't exactly about democracy as far as I'm concerned. It's different. It's about creating true community.
Mm-hmm.
People feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And can speak. And so, I mean, sexism is everywhere in our lives and in our interactions.
Mm-hmm.
But as Zen students, as people in a community, you know, I just feel it's really important just to say who we are. And not be afraid to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for your talk.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your comment. Yes.
I think Zen has taught me how to meet and greet each individual that comes into my life for who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And learn how to not get caught up into roles and as we all evolve, and it has been an evolution from the 60s on, we've seen a dynamic of changes come our way, and sometimes they become overwhelming. So Zen and my practice has helped me in looking at just the person who is presented to me and accepting them for who they are and what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And in case you couldn't hear that, I can't repeat the whole comment, but it was about, you said that Zen practice has helped you to just see the person in front of you and appreciate them and not be caught in ideas of roles and things like that. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yes, Jim.
For many years, I worked in a predominantly male industry. And there was a dynamic in which there would be a team of mostly guys or all guys, and there would be the loud guy, and he would usually make some comment about sexuality or ascertaining that he's heterosexual or surmising that someone might not be heterosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that person was doing that because he was really afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Fear. Fear at the root of it. Thank you. Yes.
Going through Asian history, one thing became clear is that Buddhism survived through a lot of violent turmoil. If you go over the history of India, China, and Japan, one story that keeps reminding me of the older men in my own family, since the political turmoil of the past decade or two, the story from a young woman that was a student at Kent State University in the year 1970. And her father, I think a woman over there heard the same news story. Her father was hearing the news at Kent State in the year was 1970, where the National Guard had killed some students, unarmed college students who were just protesting the Vietnam War. And they actually got shot to death, several of them. The father got very upset because of what he considered his nationalistic pride and said they should have just killed all of those students. his daughter said, "Daddy, I was one of the protesters."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of nationalistic herd mentality may have been necessary for some cultures to survive ancient warrior tribal culture, but it is something that we have always struggled to evolve through. And hearing things that have made it harder for my family, my larger family, to be in a room together, because I remember when I was little, they knew the Vietnam War was going on, but I don't remember big arguments or discussions in my family over what was right or wrong. We didn't talk about politics or war at all. And in the past decade, suddenly that has grown to dominate people's families. And the warrior culture and the herd mentality and the machismo nationalism and protectionism has seeped its way in a way that at least to me seems like it's uglier. And maybe I was just little.
Mm-hmm.
But that girl needing to point out to her father, "I was one of those protesters," really hit a chord with my family, or at least in the way I see my family.
Okay, thank you. Was there? Yes.
I'm Natalie. The thing that is so prominent today is change. But, you know, if you go back and you read Plato, and, you know, that's always an issue. The degree is where we are. I mean, it's always heats up or cools down. What I think happens so much is misunderstanding. And one of the things that I always rely on is being curious. Being curious and asking questions, or when I'm feeling fearful.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share that.
Mm-hmm.
Being curious, Georgia, is a really good thing.
Being curious. And next year we have appreciative. And I think those two things are wonderful. Who is this person walking toward me? You know, I still sometimes catch myself making snap judgments about people from habit, from like deep in my childhood, as if I could size somebody up by their immediate appearance. And that's so ridiculous. You know, it's so ridiculous. And it's important to work on letting that go and rather asking, well, who is this coming toward me? And delight in that person. That is a good practice. Okay, well, oh, all right, yes.
Thank you for your talk and for the topic. And it's important and difficult. I'm kind of left with an incomplete picture.
Mm-hmm.
Can't cover everything. And
right.
Complex and a lot of dynamics. I feel moved to maybe fill in.
Sure, please do. I'm sure I've left some things out.
Sometimes those last three guys, or the fourth guy who doesn't say anything, or the three guys who don't laugh, end up in positions of power later in their life and start to assert some kind of control. And especially if there's women around in work or professional situations, and I think it's, from what I've seen or experienced, it's a lot more subtle than the aggression of the loud aggressive guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the subtleness of it, especially now, since there are certain things that are just not acceptable anymore. But there's a whole host of other things that are still acceptable and a lot more subtle, that are gendered. So I don't know if you want to comment on that. The other piece too, I just have a reaction to your. Zen guys being really sweet, which I think, you know, I love everyone here. This is also a pretty male space and a white space, and I just wouldn't. I don't know.
You wouldn't say it that way.
I, you know, I,
Yeah.
I just think there's just something about being self-congratulatory because we practice.
Yeah.
And I think just because we practice it doesn't mean that there's, including myself, that there's
right.
Work here too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. That's a little congratulatory, self-congratulatory, talking about how Zen guys are sweet. And the first thing you said, I'm really glad you said that, because the kinds of things I'm talking about, this really aggressive behavior that you might encounter when you're a kid or something, we don't often encounter that kind of thing in our daily life, but there is something much more subtle and much more hidden that we encounter all the time. The way people interact with each other. And that's the level where a lot of this stuff is playing out for us. Does that reflect what you said? Not as well as you said it, but yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I'm not saying that these sort of weird, aggressive situations are sort of the norm where we're going to oppose sexism. But it's going to be much more complicated and much more subtle than that, where most of these things play out. Kind of stumbling here, but I hope I'm kind of reflecting what you said. Yes, Dennis, and then Steve. But we'll have to make this quick. We've only got maybe a minute each.
I just have to make it personal from my experience. When I was in early adolescence and then on to high school, I was tall and I was skinny. And I don't know if this is an acceptable word or not, but I was effeminate. And so I got picked on.
Mm-hmm.
And called not a very nice word. I was able to survive that. And when I saw these guys coming, I got frightened. But it occurred to me during your talk, it was kind of no mistake that right after high school, I joined the Army, became an infantry officer, and a paratrooper.
Mm-hmm.
That'll show them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I got over that, too.
Uh-huh. All right. And Steve, this will be the last comment because we're running out of time here. Sure.
I wish I was as sanguine as you are that if the day is done, you know, or whatever you said, in a rather impassioned way. I'm not at all optimistic that this is going away, either interpersonally, socially, politically. I mean, it may be modulated from time to time in certain communities, but this is very hardwired stuff in human behavior. And so all I would want to say is that, as to me at least, as one of our big challenges as Zen practitioners is accepting, it's not okay, but accepting our own anger and trying to manage our own anger and frustration against the situation or about the situation, because it might not change.
Mm-hmm.
This country may well go right down the direction of hunger in the next 2 years. It's possible, I don't think so, but it could happen. All of these behaviors have been modulated in our lifetime. Growing up in the 50s, I see the difference as you did in the 50s and 60s. But it's there. It's just, and it's not even muted, obviously, at the highest levels. So all I'm saying is we need to find constructive ways to manage this.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we buy into it with anger and just frustration, it doesn't help anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.